من دانشجوی خارجی بودم در ایران قبل از 40 سال. 40 سال پیش بودم. در دانشگاه فردوسی 1 سال درس خوندم. و من خیلی خوشحالم پدرم به من دقیق کتم سخنان بودم. من خیلی خوشحالم که چند ایرانی ها، چند ایرانی ها در آمریکا در دانشگاه هستم. So welcome. I've been teaching at Oregon State for 25 years. Many of the courses that I teach, most of the courses I teach actually deal with the Middle East. I teach a course on Iran, modern history of Iran, looking at it from the 19th century through the revolution. So I don't know if anybody in this room, I don't see any familiar faces, but a few years ago, Masoud, I don't know if you know Masoud in engineering, yeah, he used to sit in and come to my classes. So what I want to talk about today, and that, what, a half hour? Sounds good. What I want to talk about today is the sort of a very condensed version of the past 100 years of American-Iranian relations, and then we can have discussion and questions afterwards. More than 100 years ago, nobody knew a thing about Iran, about Persia. It didn't exist in the American lexicon. It just, you know, there were Oriental rugs, and that was it. And this history of this past century can be divided into three parts. The first part is up until World War II. Second part is from Mossadegh up until the revolution, and then from the revolution. So there are these distinct 30-year parts. In the first 30, 40 years of a relationship with Iran, Iranians and Americans loved each other, I think, without any kind of inhibitions or reservations. And the reason for that is you can date Americans' interest in Iran to a very specific event, which was in 1907 during the Constitutional Revolution, during the Inqilab-e Mashrutiyat. Tabriz, an American student, not much older than you, in fact, probably younger than you, recently graduated from Princeton University, went to teach English in Tabriz, and teaching Tabriz, named Howard Baskerville, and he led the demonstrations against the Qajar Shah calling for a constitution, and for his efforts got shot. So one of the very first, you know, Shahid, the very first martyr the Constitutional Revolution was an American. And the reason why Iranians liked America in the beginning of the 20th century, the reason why they liked America was because the Americans were not British and they were not Russian. Right? They were seen as neutral players. And this is true for much of America's history in the Middle East until the 50s, where the United States was considered a neutral, unbiased player. And if you'll remember in 1907, Russia and England had a secret treaty to divide Iran into spheres of influence. The North would go to Russia, the South would go to Britain. And the confidence that Iranians had in the United States and in Americans was so strong that after Baskerville was shot, they looked to the United States to provide, what we call technical support. And so in 1910, 1911, the Iranian government, the new government, called on a young American economist by the name of William Schuster to come to Iran to straighten out Iran's finances. And the main problem with Iran's government in the early part of the 20th century was the lack of revenue, right? There was no oil revenue yet. And when they started to have a deal with the British oil company to provide revenue, as you probably know, it was very little initially. And so he was determined to straighten out the finances of Iran. And he spent 2-3 years in Tehran running the treasury in Iran. And he was completely frustrated in his And he was continued to be appalled by the interventions of both the British and the Russians in Iranian affairs. So when he came back to the United States, he wrote a book, it's still in print today, it was called The Strangling of Persia, in which he recounts his efforts to try and straighten the economy of Iran and to work the better Iran. So again, I just want to point out that the relations typically between Iran and the United States during this early period, even during the end of the Qajar period, was positive. And then in 1924, an episode happened, and I say this not as an episode to say that something bad happened, but to actually talk about how the result was actually pretty good. And that was the American consul in Iran, a guy by the name of Robert Imri, was killed by a mob. He decided he would go out and take pictures. I believe it was of Ashura. People were upset that he was doing this, and he was murdered. And it's funny, I did not know the story, and usually most Americans don't know about Robert Imri. I actually, a friend of my wife, a guy went to college with my wife, was named Imri, and when I met him, he says, oh, I have a great uncle who was killed in Iran. And that was the very first time I'd heard the story. But I want to present this as a positive thing, not as a negative thing, because the United States and Iran, rather than going to war, right, which is what's happened in other sort of instances, you can think about World War I beginning because of Franz Ferdinand, another area of the world that I study, which is Morocco. The French invaded Morocco in 1907 because a French doctor was killed by a mob, very similar kind of incident. In Iran, they went to war with Russia in the 1830s, largely as a response to a Russian diplomat being killed. But the United States in 1924, when this happened, they said, okay, we'll accept reparations, right? So the Iranian government would pay money. Of course, the Iranian government had no money, and the reparations were never paid. But if you go and you look at the newspaper articles about the debate in Congress, the reparations, the $100,000 that Iran was supposed to pay, which never was never collected, but the $100,000 was supposed to set up scholarships for Iranian students to come to the United States. So I just want to say that there was this sense of goodwill of working together that an incident like that would not destroy America's relationship with Iran. After that, in fact, Iran again turned to an American to help with its finances, and this was Arthur Milspaugh, and he was there, I believe, from 24 to 27, trying to set up the treasury again, or reform the treasury in Iran, and he was again called back in 1943, late 20 years later. So there was this sense that America again had was sort of had. Was a neutral player, provided expertise, and was beneficial to Iran. Very few Iranian students came to the United States. If you want to read a very good book, it's called Daughter of Persia by Sattareh Thamanthamayan. And she describes coming to the United States to study in 1942, 43, and being virtually the only Iranian student in all of Los Angeles, which today is hard to imagine, right? And going to the University of Southern California and being the only Iranian student. So, these relations were, as I say, diplomatically, they were good. Socially, people did not know much about Iran. Right? The second period of Iranian-American relations, unfortunately, goes a little sour, and this is in 1953 with Mossadegh and the coup which overthrew Mossadegh. Britain and the United States, if you'll recall, I'm sorry, Britain and Russia, again Britain and Russia, if you'll recall, in 1941 threw out Reza Shah as the Shah, right, and they were afraid that Reza Shah was too pro-German. In any event, they wanted to supply Russia, the Soviet Union, using the trains, which was a Shah had built. And so he was put off the throne, and Muhammad Reza Shah was put on the throne. Right? He was, 19 years old. There was some American involvement in that. Certainly America supported that action. And as they say, Mills Fogg was brought in again to try and straighten Iran's economy. Some of you may remember from the first Gulf War, the general in charge was General Schwarzkopf. His father, who was the head of the New Jersey State Police, was put in charge of the gendarmerie in Iran. So there was an American involvement, and American troops, not a lot, but some were stationed in Iran to help with the supplies. And I once met a man, this is 30, 40 years ago, who told me, oh, I was stationed in Iran during the war. And he said, I learned one phrase in Persian. This is the one phrase in Persian that this American GI learned, which was, Bale, bale, chash, korban, inshallah, pas badal. The only Farsi that this guy learned after being stationed during the war in Iran. And the period between, during the war and up until, 53, when you have the coup, that 10-year period was an interesting period in Iranian politics, because it's when you have Kavam as the prime minister, rotates back and forth between different old family politicians. But there is the beginning of real democracy, and unfortunately the coup supplanted that, aborted those developments. And the United States went in wholeheartedly with Britain to stage the coup for two reasons. The British were interested primarily in oil, and the United States obviously benefited from the coup, because afterwards the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was reorganized and the American Oil Company, what was called the consortium, was allowed to have a piece of Iranian oil. But the main impetus for the United States involvement in Iran after the war is the Cold War. It's the Soviet Union. The Iranians, the American media, intentionally misrepresented Mossadegh as being pro-communist, as being aligned with the Tudeh, which he was not. And the United States government, in the height of 1953, it's the height of the Cold War, it's the height of the McCarthy hearings. If you know about that, the McCarthy hearings were American congressional investigations into people who were suspected to be communists. So all of that played into the United States supporting and bringing back Mohammad Reza Shah as the Shah after he fled to Italy, and deposing Mossadegh. Right? So the first period, as I said, was relatively benign relations between the United States and Iran. And 1953, I think, really changes the picture between the United States and Iran. Right? And there are lots of Iranians, people probably have never forgiven the United States for overthrowing Mossadegh. The Shah himself was very smart in, I would say manipulating the United States' fear of the Cold War. And he played up throughout his, how many years was he Shah? From 26 years. That quarter century, he played on the fears of the United States of the Soviet Union, right? And he presented himself as, America's great ally in the bulwark against the Soviet Union. And the United States, that largely colored our relations, American relations with Iran. That here was this country in the Middle East that was, ardently opposed to the Soviet Union, and it deserved all of our support. Right? But of course, all that support meant supporting the programs of the Shah. There were efforts to moderate the Shah and to kind of push for democracy in Iran during President Kennedy's administration. And President Kennedy pressured the Shah and said, you know, you need to liberalize. And those liberalization, those efforts to liberalize, resulted in what was called the, you know, the White Revolution, right? The idea that, reform could come from on top. But, you know, Kennedy died, and that was very short-lived. What did emerge from that, again, is this idea that America could provide technical support and that the United States had special economic expertise. And so in the 1960s, you start to see the development plans for Iran that the Shah created. And these were largely created by economists from Harvard University. So this is often referred to as the Harvard plans. This takes you through the 1960s. Things change, however, in American Iranian relations when we get to the 70s, because in the 70s, the Iranians realized, much as the Arabs realized, that they were not getting the full benefit of the revenues from the oil. And there had been the formation of OPEC, and Jamshid Amusagar, who was the OPEC minister, and then he was at one time briefly the prime minister, the Nakhost Vazir in Iran. Jamshid Amusagar, you know, engineered the quadrupling of the price of oil, right? So oil went up to an amazing $18 a barrel. So it shows you how low it was prior to that. And Iran's revenues shot up. There at the end of the 70s, Iran was getting $20 billion a year in oil revenues, which was a lot of money. And, you know, if you want to go back and look at, you know, what are the causes for the revolution, it's a whole other topic. But certainly this influx of cash and failures to distribute it in an equitable way certainly was a contributing factor. So when Iran jacked up the price of oil, you would think that would be, you know, there was a, it created what was called an oil shock in this country. There was a recession. You would think that that would taint the relationship between the United States and Iran. But in fact, President Nixon came up with a very clever way of sort of getting that money back, which was he sold airplanes and munitions to the Shah. Right? And he and Secretary of State Kissinger basically gave Iran a blank check to buy whatever weapons they wanted. F-14s were delivered to Iran before they were delivered to the American Air Force, right? So all that money that Iran was making from oil, you know, the idea was to bring it back to the United States through weapon sales. And the relationship was pretty much cemented, right? So when Jimmy Carter became president, Jimmy Carter ran on a campaign in which he said, I'm going to support human rights around the world. And Jimmy Carter was a great moralistic human being. And in Iran, and I moved to Iran, I lived there for the 2 years from 77 to 79, beginning of 79. When I arrived in Iran, everybody in Iran loved Jimmy Carter because he talked about human rights, when human rights had been one of the issues that was, you know, people condemned the Shah. And what happened was on New Year's Eve, 1977, Jimmy Carter visited Iran. And he visits Iran, and it's on national television, and he gives this famous speech, you probably have heard it, where he praises the Shah, and he says, Iran is an island of stability in the Middle East, right? And so that was really, I think, a blow to a lot of Iranians, especially a lot of college-age Iranians, a lot of young Iranians who had expectations that kind of reform would come about through Carter. There was some similar to what had happened with Kennedy 20 years earlier. And in fact, riots broke out in Tabriz, you know, the very next day after Carter's visit. And I watched that on TV. I had a roommate in the dormitory who was from Afghanistan. He wasn't from Iran, but he could see smoke was coming out of his ears. And he said, look at that on TV. The Carter kissed the Shah Banu, and the Shah kissed Rosalind on the cheek. And Pedasuchte, it was just like irate, you know. And I often thought about that, because that was, you know, this is the Shah was out, you know, when people say the Shah was out of touch, he was out of touch. That he wouldn't understand that people might even take something like that in a political light. And, you know, the rest is history. It's the revolution. And so we enter that third period of time, the time that we're in now. And it's 38 long years in which the United States has not had diplomatic relations with Iran. And, you know, in this case, I'm not saying that America is to blame or Iran's to blame, but there have been, you know, some events which get stuck. It's like a spoke in the gears, and you can't go forward. The hostage crisis made an indelible image in the American psyche. And there used to be a TV show called Nightline with a guy named Ted Koppel. You guys remember Nightline? Yeah. And he would watch it every single night, and every night would begin, this is Nightline, night 103 of the hostage crisis. The next night, night 104. And it's as if the country came to a standstill. And you know, the students that took the embassy and Ayatollah Khomeini, they knew that. They knew the kind of, you know, danger, or not the danger, the kind of situation that they were putting Americans in. You know, it came about, the reason for the, you know, with the hostage crisis was because Jimmy Carter, I'm always defending Jimmy Carter because I've always thought he was our nicest president, still, nicest living president. And Jimmy Carter took pity on the Shah, who was dying of cancer, and said he could come to New York for treatment. And that sort of provoked the taking of the embassy. So this becomes, you know, the unstoppable force, right? And there's no, you know, America freezes Iran's assets. There's no more exchange between Iran and America. Students don't come to the United States anymore. Right? Once upon a time, there were 70,000 Iranian students in the United States. So, you know, that was it brought things to a standstill, right? And if you look back on the revolution, people like Bazargan, who was prime minister, you know, he just wanted, like, you know, we threw out the Shah, let's go back to our old constitution and let's just go on and honor our commitments and be a free country. He didn't expect that Iran would be isolated in this way. So during this period, the last 38 years, there have been ups and downs. There have been moments in which Iran and the United States might have reconciled, or efforts to reconcile have been made, right? And the first effort, I think, to try and reconcile with Iran comes in, what, 1982, 83, Reagan's president, and it's what's called the Iran-Contra affair. How many people know about the Iran-Contra affair? Not so many. So our Congress, the American Congress, said you cannot give money to these counter-revolutionary rebels in Nicaragua. They were the Contras. Congress said you can't give them money. Illegally, in the White House, members of the National Security Council came up with a scheme, which was, Iran's in the middle of a war with Iraq. It needs replacements for its weapons. We can give replacements to Iran for their weapons. We can get money from Iran and give it to the Nicaraguan counter-revolutionaries, the Contras. It's a very complicated plot. And it involved having Israel or Israelis sell weapons that the United States had given to Israel to Iran. Right? And this was pursued, and there were Iranians at the other end who sort of took the bait, and it was seen as an opening to Iran. And they sent a guy named Robert McFarland, who was a White House aide, to Iran, and there was a great debate, what should he bring? And he brought a cake in the shape of a key, right on the airplane, right to Iran, to present to Iranian leaders. And the feeling was, among American politicians, that Iran is divided into hardliners and moderates, right? Have you heard that? That's the normal division. There has been a search for those moderates for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, you know, and when the moderates actually emerged, then we don't want to touch them, right? But the idea was that Rafsanjani was considered a moderate and that we could somehow open up relations again with Iran through this illegal deal. And it was discovered, and you know, nobody went to jail because of it, because the crooks don't go to jail, right? So that was the first kind of, you know, effort to try and open up relations. There have been other missed opportunities. There have been other occasions in which Iran-American relations were strained. 1985, 86, the United States shot down an Iranian airliner, right? You probably know about that, you know, mistaking it for a military plane. So all these things happen, unfortunately. So when when 9/11 occurs, this is another sort of possible turning point, right? and I think a missed opportunity. All over the Arab Middle East when 9/11 occurred, what did the Arabs do? They jumped up and down and danced in the streets, right? There was a lot of sympathy for, you know, the perception that America was getting what it deserved. The one place in the Middle East where people did not celebrate, and where people came out and commiserated, and in which there were candlelight ceremonies in 2001, was Tehran, was Iran. Because I think the Iranian population, you know, wants to reestablish relations with Iran, and wants that beyond the rapport with Iran. So there was that effort. And the United States and Iran, during the first Gulf War, and during the attack against the Taliban in Afghanistan, they cooperated militarily. There were channels open in which Iran shared intelligence that it had about the Taliban with America. So there were all these kinds of gestures, and many of these gestures are coming from the Iranian side, not just from the American side. It's genuine sympathy, I think, for the United States. Right? However, President Bush, who knows who was advising him, or if anybody was advising him, George W. Bush gave his State of the Union speech, and what did he call Iran? The Axis of Evil, right? And even the guy who wrote the speech, a guy named David Frum, says, I don't know where that line came from. You know, I wrote the speech and I had North Korea and Iraq as the Axis of Evil. You know, somebody inserted Iran at the last minute. And it was, you know, it was clearly not the State Department. The State Department was trying to re-enter relationships with Iran. And so Iran becomes the Axis of Evil. And all throughout the Bush administration, there's a tremendous hostility to Iran. There was speculation that after Iraq, Iran would be next, right? And newspaper articles like that. And to me, one of the events which, you know, doesn't get a lot of coverage was the effort by Iran when Ayatollah Khatami was president to reach out to the United States. And there was a telegram that came through the Swiss embassy, since the United States had no relations, it came through the Swiss embassy. And it was a very detailed program, you know, approved at the highest levels of the Iranian government, that to establish bilateral talks with Iran to solve their differences. And the Bush administration waved it aside, ignored it. They said, this is not genuine, right? And besides, Khatami and the reformers are going to lose anyway. So why should we invest in this? What happens is by sweeping that aside, by not accepting the olive branch that came from Iran, they pretty much confirm that the hardliners would come back into power with Ahmed in the Shah, which is what happened. And so the Bush administration, I hold, is really responsible for missing a tremendous opportunity to patch up relations with Iran. So Iran, after the Gulf War, is put in a very strange situation, because on its east, there's Afghanistan, which is now under control by the United States, and to its west, there's Iraq, which is now under control by the United States, and I may be the only person and only American in the United States who says Iran, all right, I won't say they should have nuclear weapons, but I understand why Iran would want nuclear weapons, right? Because it presented it in a position of feeling the need that they needed deterrence, right? And so, the United States has basically kind of created the situation in which it opposes Iran for wanting to pursue nuclear weapons, for taking an aggressive stance, and largely this is because Iran is responding to things which the United States has done, and these would be normal reactions for any country. So Bush, was hostile to Iran. Obama, when he was president, he gives this speech during his inauguration: if we extend an open hand, we would like Iran to unclench its fist, right? And Obama succeeds. He makes an alliance with Rouhani. They create the deal to postpone nuclear weapons. Iran wants sanctions lifted. They want money returned that the United States had been sitting on in its banks for 40 years. And I think great progress was made in Iran-American relations under the Obama administration. And once again, now the pendulum has swung back, and relations, I don't need to tell you, no more visas, they want to not cancel the deal, the Iran nuclear deal, which they can't cancel because it's an international agreement, it's not a bilateral agreement between the United States and Iran. So, that's sort of the general picture. The other point, however, which is, a point of concern for the United States, is that the United States sees Iran as the aggressor and the disruptor in the Middle East. Iran is supporting Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Iran is supporting the Houthi rebels. Right? And the United States, I'm not a diplomat, I'm not a person in the State Department, but I think they feel compelled that they have to choose sides, and if they're going to choose sides, they'll side with Saudi Arabia in this, rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia. So we're at a position now where relations are, again deteriorating as opposed to improving. Maybe the pendulum will swing in another direction. I don't know. I would certainly hope, and I'd be eager to hear your feelings. So, on that,